Welcome back, everybody. We are going to have the opportunity of learning a very special piece of Torah today. And I want to start off by first thanking the sponsors today, to thank the Lehmans who are sponsoring, Barbara and Yitzhak Lehman Siegel, who are sponsoring the Ilu Nishmas, Barbara's mother's yahrzeit, which was the 24th of Adar, Sarah Ann Lehman, Sarah Bas Yitzhak Meshulam Feish. We also are learning today the Ilu Nishmas Bear Mayor Ben Eliezer, Alan Steinmetz's grandfather, and thank you for that sponsorship. Or we also learn now today for the yahrzeit of Dr. Iris Silverstein, Yisrael Mordechai Dov Ben Zev. Yisrael Mordechai Ben Zev Dov Zev Esther, whose yahrzeit is when, Yossi? Yud Beis Adar. Adar as well, Mitzvah Shem. It should be La'alias Nishmasa. And we also thank Ed Klar, who is sponsoring for Refuah Shlema of Moshe Peretz ben Nechama and Bela Bas Gittel. And Mitzvah Shem, that the learning of the Torah and the continued discussions should be a zechus for all those we are thinking of. So let's start learning. This happens to be a shir which relates to the time, because it is around this time that is the Ides of March, but it is also the Ides of Adar. So I want to go back to originally Julius Caesar. Let's try to think of the original scene and see the similarities and perhaps the dissimilarities between what's going on then and what's going on here. As we are very familiar, in the fall of the Roman Empire, there were many stages. One of those stages was the murder of Julius Caesar. And the scene goes as follows in Act 1, Scene 2. Caesar's passing through the marketplace and he says, "What is it in the press that calls on me? I hear a tongue shriller than all the music cries. Caesar speaks, Caesar is turned to hear. The soothsayer says, 'Beware the Ides of March.' What man is that? A soothsayer bids you beware the Ides of March." So he is expected to worry about the middle of March. The Ides of March is around the middle of March. The different dates as to when it should be, the 14th and the 16th, or just the middle of March. And it turns out that he needs to be beware of this time. And this ultimately is his downfall, because he ignores this warning. We are in the Ides of... We just passed the Ides of March. The Ides of March, if we're going on the 15th, was Friday this year. We're about to enter into... And we're now entering into the middle of Adar as well. And sometimes even this Roman pagan festival is seen as a later success of this idea of Haman choosing this time, this negative aura in time, to kill the Jewish people. So in a certain sense, if we think to ourselves, maybe that's exactly what happens. Maybe the way we should look at the Haman's choice of time is exactly this idea. There's this bad time, there's this cloud, and he's choosing this moment to create the genocide for the Jews. I'd like to argue, as we go through the shir, that perhaps this is exactly the opposite. That the idea of Haman is not related to this. It's not related to a negative time. It's not related to specifically choosing a bad mazal. It's actually much more sinister than that. Very, very different to the Ides of March. So let's try to get there. First of all, I just wanted to actually take a moment to wish a mazel tov to Baruch and Esther on the birth of a grandson on Friday, Mitzvah Shem, which I'll continue mazel. And a mazel tov to Nisi Pavel and Anshul Weiss on the birth of a son yesterday, in Mitzvah Hashem. We should have continued bracha. So a lot of very special mazel tovs right off the press in Mitzvah Hashem. We should continue to celebrate together. So let's start. Let's return to the Purim, and perhaps we'll come back to the Ides of March and see how dissimilar it is in the first place. So let's start at the beginning. Two basic questions about Purim, and let's start at the beginning. I want to actually start with the second question first, because I think it's rather intriguing. We read yesterday in source 3 the maftir of Parshas Kisetse, which is Zachor. We learned about how we're supposed to remember Es Asher Lecha Asher Asol Lecha Amalek Baderech Betzeis Chemim Mitzrayim. We need to remember that terrible episode where they attacked us. And here's the irony in source 9 in Pasuk Yud Tes in Dvarim Chafei. When Hashem will give you space from all your enemies around, when Hashem gives you this land to inherit it, you should eradicate the memory of Amalek from under the heavens, and you should not forget it. And that itself is just a contradiction in terms. The way you eradicate the memory of somebody is you simply don't include them in the textbook. Very simple. That's the way it works. The history is dictated by the conqueror, and therefore you have the right to define history as you see fit, and the other person is the loser. I'm sorry, I think we're just out. I'm sorry. So that's the way it goes. I apologize. I only printed 50, so we're going to try to up the printing for source sheets and mitzvah next time. So why? Meaning, like, you know, in America now, there's a movement. There's a lady called Lori Cordoz, I think her last name is. She's a very, very active individual. She has a network called PJTN. Where she works in the Bible Belt South to deal with a number, on the Christian side, a number of the concerns about anti-Israel sentiment in this country. And one of the causes she fights against is the Common Core textbook writers in this country. Because in Common Core, there are a number of Muslims who are involved in the writing, and they are now blurring the lines of morality when it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, as an example. Right? So, meaning to say, the way that you simply remove somebody from history is you completely ignore them. And a generation or two, there'll be protests. And then after three generations, nobody remembers what really happened with that individual. Do you think about this for a second? Amalek is perhaps the most well-known nation that has been almost eradicated, if you think about it, in terms of actual, we'll call the national identity. I mean, nobody else knows about Amalek except for the Jews. Nobody else is speaking about Amalek. Right? Why are we speaking about it? Because we're supposed to eradicate their memory, because we're remembering them. So the whole idea itself seems to be an oxymoron. It doesn't seem to work together. This is not the way to eradicate their memory. That's one question. Just when looking at this Megillah, which seems so out of place. Number two is, and this is going back to source two, is the name of Purim itself, and we're told that Mordechai and Esther, when writing the Megillah, explained that in the following, in source 2, in Esther Perek Tes, this rabid anti-Semite, Choshev al Yehudim, la'abdom, wanted to eradicate the Jews, he threw this lottery to eradicate them, skipping to Pasuk Chavav, al-ken karu la'yamim ha'ele Purim, al-shem ha'pur. It is called Purim because of what basically what we translate is the lot. Therefore, this is why it's written. By the way, we spent a little bit of time last year and thinking about why the interceding pasuk is there. Why the Al Kain is interrupted by pasuk Kofay, which seems to be out of place. Nonetheless, not for now. But it seems funny because, again, Purim seems to be at best, an ancillary detail. You know, it would be the same as saying the Entebbe raid being known as, you know, the, you know, Wilfred Bozé, you know, day, because he was one of the lead hijackers. It's like, no, we don't care about him. He's not part of the scenery. We don't name the day because of that. And in fact, it's not only just that it's that the lottery was the negative part. It doesn't seem to be the main part of the story at all. It happened to be that was just the vehicle that he got to the date. The point would have been the genocide itself. So we could call it Genocide Day, we could call it Salvation Day, we could call it Ring Day, we could call it Feast Day, you know, all the other details that are parts of the Geula process. But the Purim seems to be a very ancillary detail to the whole story, and it seems to nonetheless play a central role. So these are the two questions. Let's see if we can come back to them and get a sense of what's going on here. I would argue, and this is where it comes from, is that we need to go back to what Haman was really trying to do, why he was choosing this particular period in time, why the Ides of Adar was the time that he chose, and why that's central to his attack on the Jews. So here's how it goes. Let's go back to the original Amalek story itself in Zachar in source 3. We're told that the operative word, the atrocity which Amalek committed was, for which we remember them for all time immemorial, is in Pasuk Yud Ches. In source 3, we're told, Asher korcho baderech, they were korcho on the way. What does that mean? They were korcho. That's the only word we have to describe in history what actually happened to them. So what was this word? Rashi tells us a few options as to what could have happened. In source 4, Rashi says, Arsher karacha ba'derech, lashon mikre. How do you translate the word mikre? Happenstance, right? So it happened. It happened upon you. You know, they were walking through the desert. We were walking through the desert. And what would you know? Look at that. They bumped into us. That's one option. Another option is lashon keri, betuma, shayasam etamosam b'mishkav zachur. It's also a description in the halachas of Tumah and Tahara. Keri is a seminal emission which refers to a notion of Tumah or a notion of lack of commitment which reflects itself in Tumah. So that's another aspect of what they represent. And another one is Dovar Acher, Loshon Kar V'chom. It is a Kar V'chom. It is an expression of cold and heat. So Tzononcha, they cooled you down. They made you cooler through this. And this is the famous example Rashi gives about the bath, which is boiling, and somebody jumps in to show you that it's not really so bad, even though they burn themselves. Those are the three options as to what it is. Let's focus on the first one, the idea of mikre. It just seems strange. You know, it sounds like Loshon mikre, Asher korcho baderech. They were wandering through the desert with their army, and they happened to bump into Israel, and then something happened. You know, there was a skirmish. That sounds very strange. Sounds like there's more going on here. What does it mean that there was a happenstance that they met each other? So what really I think is under the microscope right now is the conception of time. How do you view time? Is what is afoot. So for example, maybe perhaps in musical terms, looking at music as staccato versus legato. When you have staccato, you have note, right? You have different notes which are played. Legato is when there's a sort of a liquid movement, not a fire movement, but there's a liquid movement as the one note intermingles with the next. The way that Amalek looks at time is korcha. Korcha means to say, happenstance means that you look at each note, you look at each individual happening in time as its own individual silo. Right, every little piece is separate from the next piece of time, the next packet, the next unit of time. Therefore, there might be correlation, but there's no causation between these different moments in time. That's a very significant argument. Asher korcha, what they were essentially saying is, if you think about it, is they were saying, look, it makes sense. I get it. That, you know, that it happens to be Egypt had a really bad year. You know, this whole blood thing and then the frog thing and then the lice thing. I mean, like, you know, it really was a bad year for the Egyptian economy. And the winds were blowing really hard that night when the Hebrews happened to be on the banks of the Red Sea. We get it. You know, and we can still prove today, and there's still theories and papers being written by very, very astute professors about how it could be that at the right conditions, with the right vacuum and winds, that there could be the sea could recede a little bit. We understand that, and, you know, it all happens to be, these all happen to be, you know, just a sequence of negative events. But they are still, at the same time, still silos of bad events. That doesn't have any impact on the way we look at the world, right? So we can attack you because it just happened to be that you were lucky, you know, 12 times in a row, sorry, 10 times in a row throughout this year. Just thinking about this notion of the way to look at time, just a few examples of how it's expressed. Have anybody ever had a chance to read Tom Stoppard's play called Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead? It's a side play to Hamlet, where he takes two of the really side characters in Hamlet, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, and explores a lot of very interesting philosophical ideas. One of them is the following. So in the play, it starts off where they're flipping coins. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are flipping a coin, and what's uncanny is it keeps on landing on heads. So here's one of the earlier parts of the scene. It says, Guildenstern is flipping a coin. There's an art to the building up of suspense. Rosencrantz, heads. He flips another. Though it can be done by luck alone. Heads. If that's the word I'm after. 76 love, meaning 76 heads in a row. Guildenstern goes up and has nowhere to go. He spins another coin over his shoulder without looking at it. His attention being directed at the environment or lack of it. Heads. And Guildenstern finally says, a weaker man might be moved to re-examine his faith, if in nothing else, at least in the law of probability. Meaning to say, it seems like it's getting too uncanny. We have to think about why it is that it keeps happening. Why is heads keep on happening? Statistical probability will dictate that at least half, the bigger the sample set, we'll get to an approximation of half, that half of them will be heads, half of them will be tails. Why is it that reality is dictating a difference? Another example in terms of science is in the creation of the world. I apologize, it's not the best rendition of this, but this is a history of nearly everything by Bill Bryson. He's talking about the evolution of life itself, and he's describing the lack of likelihood that life should organic life should arise out of inorganic life. Here's the way he describes it. Proteins are what you get when you mix a string of ammonia acids together, and we need a lot of them. No one really knows, but there may be as many as a million different types of protein in the human body, and each one a little miracle. By the laws of probability, proteins shouldn't exist. To make a protein, you need to assemble ammonia acids, which I'm obliged to say by long traditions to refer to here as the building blocks of life, in a particular order, in much the same way as you assemble letters in particular order to spell a word. The problem is that the words in the ammonia acid alphabet are often exceedingly long. To spell collagen, the name of a common type of protein, you need to arrange 8 letters in the right order. But to make collagen, you need to arrange 1,055 ammonia acids in precisely the right sequence. But here's the obvious and crucial point. You don't make it. It makes itself spontaneously without direction, and this is where the unlikelihoods come in. The chances of 1,055 sequence molecule like collagen spontaneously self-assembling are frankly nil. It just isn't going to happen. To grasp what a long shot its existence is, visualize a standard Las Vegas slot machine, but with 1,055 spinning wheels instead of the usual 3 or 4. And with 23 symbols on each wheel, one for each of the common ammonia acids. How long would it take you to pull a handle before all 1,055 symbols come up in the right order? Well, keep trying. Effectively, never. Forever. Even if you reduce the number of spinning wheels to 200, which is actually a more typical a number for an ammonia acid for a protein, the odds against the 200 coming up in a prescribed order is 1 in 10 to the 260. That's 1 followed by 260 zeros. That in itself is a larger number than all the atoms in the universe. So I'd just like to appreciate like the likelihood of life just spontaneously arriving, moving from the inorganic to the organic, is basically nil. So how does he explain it? I mean, he's not going to church on Sunday, right? So how does this work? So he says in the next paragraph, the second paragraph on the right-hand column, imagine if you took all the components that made up a human being, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and so on, and put them into a container with some water, gave it a vigorous stir, and outstepped a completed person. That would be amazing. Well, that's essentially what Hoyle and the others, including what many ardent creationists argue, that they suggest that proteins spontaneously formed it at once. They didn't. They can't have, as Richard Dawkins argues in the Blind Watchmaker. Richard Dawkins is one of the most vociferous anti-creationists. Atheists are out there, and he wrote a book called The Blind Watchmaker in response to the famous experiment of the watchmaker where suddenly you'll find a watch in the desert and couldn't have self-assembled itself. So he writes a book arguing against God's involvement, and he says there must have been some kind of cumulative selection process that allowed amino acids to assemble in chunks. By the way, that was the American pronunciation there. I understand. Amino acids, yes. Perhaps 2 or 3 amino acids linked up for some simple purpose, and then after a time, bumped into other similar small clusters, and in doing so, discovered some additional improvement. So yes, meaning to say, it was an evolving process. It wasn't all at once. There were stages where a few acids grouped together, and then a few other acids grouped together, and some of the slot machine wheels got stuck, right? And slowly there was an evolvement process. Yes. I mean, like, yes, you could choose to see things like that. You really could. And the point is that we're going to look at little pieces here. You know, that this little piece will happen, this little piece will happen, this little piece will happen. And rather than seeing that, yes, it could be like that, but there was actually an invisible thread which was pulling all the little pieces together into one long, not mikra, but we'll call it plan, divine plan. Amalek's quite happy with seeing everything in this little piece. We'll look at this. Oh, look at that. 5 acids linked up in the sequence. Oh, another 5 acids linked up in the sequence. Oh, it's another head. You're right. You know, 76 heads. It could happen like that, right? But that's the way Amalek looks at the world. Lashon Mikra, happenstance, as opposed to viewing it as, we'll call it, trajectory. There's a legato. There's a bigger buildup which is occurring over here. That is the problem that Amalek brings to the world. And why did they attack Israel? The answer is because they attacked Israel when we had lost our sense of perspective. As the Netziv points out in Source 7, take a quick look at this. This is Rav Naftali Yehuda Berlin. He points out, he's vata ayef v'yogea. Why were you tired? He says at the time that Amalek attacked us, Pirush Rashi b'tzama, that you are thirsty. V'nira lahoysif al pi shebi'arna b'pashas b'shalach, shenens unen shebetzama kabasher hisonanu v'loha yutzameim. Why were they punished with a lack of water? Because they were complaining about their food situation. V'lo yaminu shakadosh baruch hu yodea shehem enon tzameim be'emes. They didn't think that, they didn't realize that HaKadosh Baruch Hu really knew that they weren't really so thirsty. Meaning, when they looked at reality, they saw that they were abandoned in the desert. They didn't realize that even though we've just been escorted by God through the Red Sea itself, right, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's got water covered, right? You know, he worked out the waterworks. But nonetheless, we're walking out the other side and we're like, you know, God, we're a little thirsty over here, right? So we ourselves, we're not connecting the dots. Well, what happens when we don't connect the dots? In walks another nation who says, we don't connect dots. We're quite happy to divest you of any belief that there might be a greater creator. This is just what happens, right? Now let's sort it out. We're going to, for once and all, sort out this vendetta, and let's begin now. That's what Amalek was doing, why they were entering into our circumstance. Just to give it another way of looking at this. You know, the famous story is Rabbi Akiva, the Gemara in Brachos talks about how Rabbi Akiva wanted to go to a town at night, and he couldn't find a place, an interstate, so he was left in the forest, and he has his donkey, and he has a donkey, and a rooster, and a flame, and slowly but surely the whole night happens, and the donkey, so the way my children come home talking about it from nursery school is that the donkey was taken away by a lion. I don't know where the donkey went away with the lion. And then the cat took away the chicken. We don't know where they went out for dinner. But nonetheless, each of them got taken away. And then the flame was also taken away by the wind. And he's left out in the dark, in the cold. And you can imagine it must have been one long cold night. And the next morning he realizes that everybody was exiled from the city. There was an attack on the city. And he was saved because he was left out in the forest. And if he had the donkey, he would have... You know, they would have heard it, and if he had the rooster, they would have heard that, and if he had the light, they would have seen that, and therefore it's because of all these this chain of events that he was ultimately saved. But the problem with the Amalek way of looking at history, which is very much a Western way of looking at history, is we'll look at each one, we'll take a poor picture, and there's Rabbi Akiva, you know, sitting there with, you know, the carcass of his poor donkey, and, you know, hashtag woe is me, and like, you know, if we look at a piece of the picture, it's terrible, right? And there's Rabbi Akiva chasing after the cat with the chicken, and, you know, and another picture, and there's the picture of Rabbi Akiva sitting there crying over his blown out candle with no matches, and everything looks terrible. But ultimately, if one looks at each little event individually or discreetly, then one sees a tragic event. But it's a long night. One needs to wait till the morning. And I think Rabbi Akiva was actually really a marshal just to all of our galus. We see event after event after event, and they're all terrible events. Well, one thing after the next, and we mourn them individually, and we do everything we can to avoid them. But ultimately, they're still part of the night. It's still part of the long trajectory which we need to get to the morning, but we look at them in a discreet fashion, and we don't appreciate them. Just over Shabbos, I was reading a book called Angel Among Men, which is a biography of Rav Kook. Everybody should have a chance to read it. It's really, really incredible. So in 1929, he penned a letter in response to the Mufti of Jerusalem's edict. It's very fascinating. What happened in 1929? So there was the Cheron massacre, but it was actually followed the Jerusalem massacre. There was two sets of massacres that were going on at the time, and the reason that occurred was because the Mufti of Jerusalem said that the Jews were going to take over the Temple Mount. And why was that? Because on Yom Kippur they put a mechitza and a bench at the Kotel. The Jews were diving at the Kotel. They put up a mechitza there so the men and women could dive in separately because there were more people as more people came, and they put a bench there, and that was seen as changing the status quo. The Jews were going to take over Temple Mount. That's what the Mufti said. And therefore they ran their cows through on Yom Kippur while everybody was davening. And the next day they came with arms and they attacked the Jews. And over 100 Jews were killed. And there were some Jews who defended themselves. And the Mufti of Jerusalem released an international statement which he translated into Hebrew and he put it into the international papers. And it was entitled that the Jews on the Temple Mount or at the Kotel is a privilege, not a right. That was his statement. Rav Kook wrote a response to the Mufti of Jerusalem. And part of the argument is the lack of context of his description. He described, and remember this is 1929, not 2019, he described how the Arabs had come in a peaceful protest with their swords and guns, and the Jews had antagonized them into and started attacking them, and in self-defense, they had massacred 100 defenseless Jews in Hebron and Yerushalayim. Right? And by the way, as sometimes when you see this, it's a little bit, it gives us a little bit of a chizuk to understand that things haven't changed. Right? The peaceful marches on the Gaza border, right? The things have not changed in the way the Arabs self-describe their victimhood as they are trying to attack. Things have not changed over 100 years. It's unbelievable to see. And the audacity of such a claim. But the audacity of the claim comes when you look at things out of context. I mean, it comes when you look at an event and you take a picture of that soldier who's taking a shot at a group of protesters, and there's smoke in the background, and we look at it and we say, oh, look at that. When on Thursday night, if not now, tweets and they say, our hearts are with the Gazans who are being attacked by the Israeli Air Force, hashtag Gaza under attack. It's like, well, yeah, the 3 Grad rockets over Tel Aviv. I mean, like that, you know, that was just a, you know, that was just a mistake, right? That's what they're claiming, right? So meaning to say, like, you know, meaning, yes. When you look at a snapshot of the picture, then you come out with, you know, huge emotional outcomes. But that's not the way we look at history. We don't read history as little snapshots. We look at it as a trajectory. That is exactly what Amalek's mistake was. To phrase perhaps Amalek's sentiment in John Lennon's Beautiful Boy, life is what happens to you while you're busy making other plans. It's like, yeah, you know, I was trying to go somewhere and the tire burst, right? I was trying to do this and, you know, so-and-so, you know, one of the kids threw up. Yeah, okay, that's an event, but that's part of the chain. You're supposed to be there. We understand there's a calling. The way that Rav Hirsch explains it. Did I put Rav Hirsch in here? Oh, yeah, did I not put in Rav Hirsch? Oh, it is. Baruch Hashem. Okay, good. In Saul 6, listen to this remarkable way of looking at reality. Rav Hirsch is quoting at the beginning. We're talking about Tzel Korasi. We're talking about the time of Lot. And he comments on the fact that the word Kara, which is Mikre, is related to the word kara with an aleph, which means to call. Take a look at the second indentation. Kara to call means, to cause someone to turn in our direction, physically or mentally. One who calls us changes our course and turns us in his direction. Mikre, what happens to us by chance, is a new development we could not foresee in our path, an event that calls to us and changes our direction. What we call chance appears to happen by chance only because we did not anticipate or foresee it. However, inasmuch as it was hidden from our eyes, it was foreseen and foreknown by the one who called the generations from the beginning. Mikre, chance, does not befall us. Rather, we are called to it, and it calls to us. Kara, kara. Meaning, every happening is actually a calling. But if we look at it independently, then we risk perhaps making the mistake of saying, it just happened. That was that frame. That was that snapshot of reality. And like, okay, it happens. Bad things happen. There's another word to use for that, right? So I mean to say, this is the way of looking at the world. Is okay, things happen, and that's the way I'm going to deal with it. That's the way that Amalek looks at the world. There's no input. There's no way I should change my life. Perhaps correct it or change the trajectory, and that's perhaps exactly what's happening with Haman. When Haman uses the lottery, it's not as if he could have just said, you know, next Tuesday. I like Tuesdays. Next Tuesday, Achashverosh. It would have been a much safer bet for him if he'd just chosen a specific date. Think about that, right? He was standing on the 14th of Nisan, and he could have just said, maybe we needed like, you know, a few weeks to arm. So we'll give them two weeks to arm and genocide, right? Maybe he needed a little bit of time for the propaganda. Give him a month, right? But in the end of the day, he didn't need to use the lottery. Why did he use the lottery? So what he was doing over here is not because he was looking for, you know, a terrible time for the Jews. What he was doing was exactly the opposite. He said, you guys believe in this hashkacha, you believe that there's a story to history, you believe that God looks after you. Well, let me tell you something. I don't believe that. I believe that everything's pretty random over here. God went fishing a long time ago, and I'm going to kill you. I'm going to slate your destruction in a way which is completely and absolutely random. I'm going to use exactly the opposite of your theology to show how powerless you are. I'm just going to throw this dice on the table. I'm going to spin that wheel, and wherever it lands, you're going to die, and you have no control. It's going to be the blind goral. That's how it's going to work. As the Ralbag says in Source 9, we're talking shazar goral ma'pilim al tzad ha'keri, k'moy ma'sha his parsem ma'hazayot ha'goral asher yikru'um chachmas ha'afar. It's completely random. Why does he use the lot? Because he wants to show there's no divine plan here. It was his ultimate attack. It was his ultimate attack on Jewish theology, not just in terms of genocide. You're going to die whenever I want, and you're absolutely powerless to the blind Goral. Now, you see that things get bad when you look at what happens with Esther. Because when Esther starts reporting this event to Mordechai, how does she say it? In Perek Dalet, we have a little a reprieve between the bangings for Haman. And what happens is there's this conversation between Mordechai in clandestine conversation between Mordechai and Esther. He sends in a messenger. She sends a message back. And this is what she sends him. So she sends out Hasach. So what happens is they describe what's the word over there? Asher? Korohu. Wait a second. That's the wrong language, right? Meaning, look what happened to us. That's the wrong perspective. That's the wrong perspective on what's going on over here. This didn't just happen, but in a certain sense, this voice is being influenced by precisely Haman's voice. Haman's voice is saying, yes, I will throw this lot, and that's how you're going to die. And what was his response? Oh, Asher Koro. That's not how it works. This is, in fact, specifically a divine message which needs to be countered by understanding that we look at time differently. And that's perhaps why it is that, ironically, in the very Goral itself was very much the divine providence. So famously, we know that Ibn Ezra quotes the Chazal, which says that he chose the month of Adar because he might have thought there was a negativity to it, but ultimately it turned out to be Moshe Rabbeinu's birthday, as an example. The Malbim says one step further. Well, how did he get to the 13th of Adar? Why was that the day for destruction? Very simple. What happens is he threw lots. First it was Michodesh L'Chodesh, Miyom L'Yom, from day to day, and then from Michodesh L'Chodesh. How did it work? So he first threw the lottery on days of the month. But he was standing on the 14th of Nisan. So what's the furthest day from the 14th of Nisan? Is the 13th. Right? So it means that he gives the Jews a full time. So the first lot he threw was days. It landed, as the Malbim says, one full month away from him. Then he threw Michodesh L'Chodesh. What's the first month from Nisan? Is Adar. So meaning to say, ironically, because if he'd gone the opposite order, it would have been further away. But he did from day to day to month. And because he did that, what ended up happening? It ended up being the furthest possible time from the time that he chose. So ironically, in his complete happenstance, in his complete mikre, is the greatest orchestration of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's the irony of the whole business. Is through this ultimately the redemption. Now let's take it one step further. That means to say that when you really look at the name of the Megillah, we're looking at not just the salvation, but we're looking at the means of salvation. It's the same tool that he was using, which was the psychological warfare of randomness, which became ultimately the salvation for the Jews themselves. And just to give you an example of how this looks, just for a moment over here. That's perhaps why it is, I'm trying to see if we have this. Oh yeah, we do, Baruch Hashem. Is the turning point of the Megillah is, how do we vanquish the ideology of Amalek, ideology of Haman? How do we take happenstance or discrete events and we connect them? There's a word for that, and that's called memory. What does memory do? Memory doesn't look at each independent event separately. It pulls them all together and says, there's a chain. There's a perspective here. Isn't it fascinating that when describing how we're supposed to remember Amalek in what we're about to read in the Kriyas Torah on Purim itself in Source 14, what are we supposed to do? We need to write down as a zecher about Amalek. Why? It's not just that we need to remember it. It's the memory itself unpins their ideology. Because memory is what vanquishes Mikra. Similarly, that's why in Esther, the moment towards redemption of Achashverosh, or his moments of redemption, is memory itself. Later on, the turning point of the Megillah itself, what undermined the plans of Haman was, when the king started remembering. It wasn't just an event that happened in the past, that Mordechai happened to be there when Bigson and Seresh were making a plan. No, there's actually a plan. That's why in the response to the Megillah itself, Esther and Mordechai write, these days are always remembered. Their memory will never be obliterated. Why? Because memory itself is the only way to attack the notion of mikra, which is why that's exactly the duality of the zachar, of zachar, of remembering Amalek. How do we eradicate Amalek? It's not that we write them out of the textbook. It's we start remembering. We start putting in context the whole night. We start looking at all the events in a sequence. We start realizing that perhaps it's a very long night, and intergenerationally we haven't seen the full ending of this night. But there's a story being told, and the story has a trajectory, and sometimes it takes dips, and sometimes it has rises. But it's a story. It's not a train of independent events. And that's perhaps why it is that the Megillah itself is exactly this notion. The Megillah itself explicates this very idea. Just to give you a few examples of some are more famous, some less famous, of how it takes to read history. And that is that everything in the Megillah is hidden. In fact, obviously, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's name is absent. When you look at the story, it looks like a chain of political events in the Persian Empire. Hashem's not there. But as famously is known, the Megillah is written, and the hiddur of the Megillah is what's called the Megillas HaMelech, which means, and if you look at some of the Megillahs which are written today, the top of every column has the word HaMelech, which means, yes, you're looking at Persian events, but really what are we doing? We're uncovering the HaMelech which is in the Haggadah, the real Melech behind the scenes. Esther's name, what does the word Esther mean? Yes. Mizan Hidden. What's her Hebrew name? Hadassah. Well, you know the Gemara says about Hadassah, interesting thing, is that the Hadassah is called a Hadass because its leaves cover its branches. In fact, that's one of the psulim in a Hadass on Sukkot, meaning another expression of covering. Mordechai, what's Mordechai mean? Where does it come from in the Torah that the Gemara tells us? Mordror, Mordachia, which is a spice. When is that spice used? Only one time a year. Where? As it's brought into Lifnai v'Lifnim. Yom Kippur, when it's brought inside. Meaning, where's Mordechai's expression? Is internal. When you look at these things, it looks like a chain of events. You need to look a little deeper. More than that, isn't the word Megillas Esther exactly that point? Esther is hidden, Megillah is revealed. Megillas Esther, the point of looking at history is the ability to be able to see something and revealed. Megillah, Megalim et ha-Hester, revealing that which is hidden, which is the ultimate story. Perhaps to take it even one step further. That's why it is that halachically speaking, for all those Balei Kriya who lay in the Megillah and will be laying the Megillah this year, there's a halacha that Rama brings up in Tafresh Tzadi in Sif Yud Zayin, which is that when you read the Megillah, it has to be all unfurled, right? It's wrapped over itself, right? Why is that? I mean, you say it's much more convenient if you just keep unrolling it as it goes. The point is that you can never appreciate the full story of Purim unless you have it all open. You can't look at history when you look at it as one column, one word, one sentence, one snapshot. The way that we take revenge on Amalek's view of the world is we look at it all in one long trajectory, one long picture. It's one long igeris. That's why the halacha reflects that. I'd like to close with the words of the Rambam. The Rambam says in the beginning of Hilchos Tanis, the following. Really, really, I did not actually put this in the sources, but this is the way the Rambam looks at this. The Rambam is talking about when bad things happen to the Jewish community, what do? And our response is fasting. So he says the following. He says, "V'davar zeh." This is quoting from the beginning of Hilchos Tshuva, Tanios, in Perek Aleph Halacha Beis. "V'davar zeh midarkei Tshuva hu." This is the way of Tshuva. "Shebizman shetavoy tzarav yizaku alel v'yariu yedu akol shebiglal maaseim haroyim hoira lohem." Now, when bad things happen to the Jewish community, we don't just contact our members of Congress. We don't just complain. We don't just write op-eds. We say there must have been something that we did which warranted this, and we can fix. So we're going to stop pointing outwards, we're going to start pointing inwards. Not to blame the victim, but to see what we can correct in the eyes of Hashem. Then he goes further. Kakosuv, avonoseim hitzu v'goymer. V'zeu shiyigram lohem la'asir ha'tzara me'aleihem. And that's what's going to alleviate the tzara. Aval, says the Rambam. Be very careful. Im lo yizaku v'lo yariu. If you're not going to call out in pain, you're not going to wail to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Ela yomru dava zemi minago elam. You're going to say, this is the kind of thing that happens. You know, members of Congress sometimes say anti-Semitic comments. Right? It's the kind of thing that happens, right? Ammonia acids just align themselves, right? Heads keep happening. Roosters are killed in the middle of the night. All these kind of things happen, don't they? He says, I raise the derech achzorios. What does that word mean? It's cruelty. That's a cruel way of looking at reality. That perspective. The goremes lohem li dovek b'maasem arim. It continues to allow us in the spiral of negative action. Toesif atzorot zoros acheros v'zer shekosu b'torah. And that's what the Torah says. V'alachtem imi bekeri. When you walk with me with happenstance, when you look at your lives, Jews, and you see it as independent events, and therefore it has no impact on your lives, v'alachti imochem v'chamas keri. I'll keep treating you like that. says Hashem. You want to live a life of happenstance? I'll keep you giving you random events to deal with because you're not taking them to heart. That's what the Rambam says. And that's why it says, Kelomar kashavya lechem tzara kadai shetoshuvu im tomru shul keri oisif lochem chamas oisar keri. You want to do tshuva? That's fantastic. That's what I'm asking of you. Not, I'm going to continue all the random happenings. The lesson of Purim is one that sometimes we need to look a little deeper into the story. And the way we look deeper is with breath. Ironically, is we need to see the whole story. We need to have the whole Megillah rolled out. Because without that, every event seems like its own mikra. Thank you very much.
Nachon,
very good, excellent.